are in session. We have a large number of bills set for this morning. I will explain to you that the bills at the beginning of this list are set for what are often called tap-in, tap-out hearings. If you've seen the hearings list, I'd ask you to take a look at page 2 and that list of bills. I would like to know, just by raising of hands, if there's anybody here who wants to testify on each of these page 2 bills. So I'm going to call them out and ask you to raise your hand to see if I need to call someone up. House Bill 3522. All right, no hands. House Bill 3046. No hands. House Bill 2744. I see two hands. Okay. House Bill 3084. One hand. House Bill 2902. No hands. House Bill 2434. One hand. All right. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to quickly call us into hearing and out of hearing on the bills for which no one is here. Frankly, what these bills are being, what we're doing is we have a hearing deadline as of tomorrow to hold a hearing on bills, and just in case we are holding hearings on these bills, I will hear from the folks who are here who raise their hands. I'll make sure we do call those up after we do some other business, because I do have some folks that I need to bring on a priority basis on some other bills that are earlier on the agenda. But what I will do is call us into public hearing on House Bill 3522. Hearing is convened. Seeing no witnesses, the hearing is adjourned. I will call us into public hearing on House Bill 3046. The hearing is convened. Seeing there are no witnesses, the hearing is adjourned. Oh, I love hitting that gavel. House Bill 2902. Hearing is convened. Seeing there are no witnesses, the hearing is adjourned. House Bill, well, that's the only ones that I can do that on. All right. Now, we are going to go back to the regular agenda. I have one gentleman who has to leave at 8:30 who is a state police officer, and I'm going to gavel us in for that one witness, Mr. Jim Botwinis. You are here on House Bill 3342, and then we're going to move back to 3583 as soon as we do this. So I'm convening the public hearing on House Bill 3542. I'm going to ask counsel to summarize the measure. We will hear from Mr. Botwinis. I will then gavel us out of this hearing to get back to the regular agenda, and we will pick up with 3342 then when we are done with 3583. If 3583 runs unduly long, I may break that hearing for a while to get in these other witnesses who have quicker testimony on other bills. I'm trying to balance things out. I'm also going to ask, while things are quiet at some point, that Patsy would take a look at the sign-up sheets to see if there's anybody who is from a distance who came in to testify on any of this long list of bills so that we don't make that person miss out today. I do not intend to have a work session, although we technically have the right to have a work session, on any of the bills on page 1 or any of the bills on page 2. I'll check with counsel about 3086.
That's supposed to be public hearing only.
All right. That, too, will just be a public hearing. So to give you a heads up, we are not anticipating any work sessions on these bills today. That does not mean that we will not have a work session, but it just means that we expect that any work sessions would be in the future, probably next week if there's to be a work session, but not necessarily next week, depending on what happens. But again, I've told a couple of members of this committee we did not expect to have any work sessions today, and I always try to stick to that so that if they have to go out and testify, which is the case for two of our members, they'll know that they won't come back and find out we moved a bill without giving them a chance to participate. Well, back to you, Mr. Botwinis. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Welcome to the committee, and please I need to have counsel summarize the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I can do that in about 10 seconds. This bill requires the Department of State Police to hire 125 additional patrol officers each year for the next 2 years and appropriates monies for that purpose. It also declares an emergency.
Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first off, thank you for letting me get in here and get out in a very timely fashion. I appreciate that. My name is Jim Botwinis. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. As committee counsel just stated, the House Bill 3342 would provide an additional 125 troopers each year for the next 2 years. We have been working with the department for some time on gaining additional troopers and Mr. Chair, I think you're aware on the other committee you serve on that our budget currently has funding in it for 100 additional troopers, and we're certainly grateful and appreciative of that fact. However, it's still far short of where we realistically need to be. Since the Department of State Police funding was removed from the Oregon Department of Transportation in 1980 by the voters of Oregon, our department has been on a downhill journey. Shortly after being placed in the general fund, our department received approximately 2.52 cents of every general fund dollar. Today, we receive 1.6 cents of every general fund dollar, and we are a much larger agency than we were minimally 5 years ago. Statistics bear out the dilemma the department has faced during the last two decades. It is unacceptable that our workforce has declined 38% since 1980, while Oregon's population has increased by 65% in the same time period. And while our workforce has declined 38%, automobile registrations have increased by 37%, licensed drivers by 27%, and miles traveled by 53% since 1984. All of us drive Oregon's highways and see some of the outrageous and crazy things that motorists are doing today. With less and less law enforcement presence, boldness and thoughts of "I can get away with it" appear to be commonplace. One only needs to drive north into our neighbor state, Washington, to see the difference in driving habits. One only needs to count the number of troopers between the border and Seattle to figure out why. I personally have driven to Seattle many times, and on many occasions have counted as many as 15 Washington State Patrol troopers between the Oregon-Washington border and Seattle. You can drive the entire length of Oregon on I-5 and not see more than two or three troopers, and that's if you are lucky. You can drive the entire width of Oregon on Interstate 84 and never see more than two or three troopers, and that is if you are lucky. You can drive from corner to corner diagonally and never see more than two or three troopers, and that is if you are lucky. The department's community-based budget analysis budget shows that we need 416 more troopers. Another study, the personnel allocation model, PAM, shows that we need 340 more troopers than we have today. My guess is, not having actually run the numbers, if we were still operating at 2.52 cents of every general fund dollar, we wouldn't be here asking for more troopers. The funds would be there to be able to accomplish that. My desire and request to you is that your troopers, who protect our families each day by performing a variety of tasks, will receive the help they need. It's not just about getting the job done, it's also about officer safety. Having to wait 30 minutes or more for a backup unit to arrive in a serious situation should not be acceptable to the state of Oregon, just as it is not acceptable in other police agencies. As an example, I talked personally with Senior Trooper Doug Larson from the Burns office, and he told me that on a frequent basis they make contacts with people that they have been trained not to contact by themselves. However, for public safety, they do it anyway. In these situations, more likely than not, help is at least 30 minutes away, and in some cases it can be as long as 2 hours or more. 30 minutes, let alone 2 hours, is placing an officer in a situation they should not have to be in. Again, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your concern and support for our department.
Thank you, Mr. Botman. And I would ask you, when you have a chance, working with Mr. Cross, your able advocate, to see if you could go back and check up to the time the Highway Trust Fund was shut off, what percentage of the Highway Trust Fund dollars were used for policing highways? If we could look at a couple of biennia, that would be helpful information.
Sure.
As a point of reference in terms of Senator Hannon's proposal for tapping into the Highway Trust Fund once again.
We'll be happy to provide that for you.
I see no questions, so thank you for coming this
morning. Thank you again.
You're welcome. We will recess the hearing on House Bill 3342, and we will convene the hearing on House Bill 3583. Counsel, would you please summarize the measure?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In the bill's original form, which is before the committee, what this bill does is to create the crime of partial birth infanticide. It is not in the bill ranked as a felony. It simply specifies that it is a felony, but does not specify whether it is a Class A, Class B, or Class C. And there are also some exceptions. For example, if a physical condition endangers the life of the mother, or if no procedure other than partially delivering and intentionally causing the death of the fetus would save the life of the mother. There are also the -6 amendments before the committee, which I can explain at a later point in time if the chairman would like me to.
That would be fine. Thank you. And colleagues, we
got them yesterday, and they, I believe, are on the table.
As I will explain to folks who may not be familiar with the process, because we have legislators who have to be in other committees, we try to call them up out of order so they can then go to other hearings to listen to citizens testify in their own committees. I have two legislators here. What I will do is I will ask those two legislators to come up in a moment, and as legislators arrive, I may need to call them in. I assume, Representative Pierce, that you're here to testify in this, and then Senator Shannon is. Since I think Senator Shannon is a proponent, I will call her up first, and then I'll call you up second, Representative Piercy. Senator Shannon, come on up. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Marilyn Shannon, Senator of Clinton District 15. And Mr. Chair and committee members, council, it's a pleasure to be here speaking for these unborn babies that have almost made it to life outside the womb. And the main reason that I points that I want to bring up, it was written infanticide because all but 2 inches of the baby's head is delivered. It's all there. And I think that Gail Atterbury may talk a little more about the procedure, but for this procedure to happen, you have to deliver the baby feet first. And they go up and they turn the baby, and these are babies that are full term. And all they're depending on their mother truly is a little warmth, food, and getting rid of and waste disposal, getting rid of that. And otherwise, they're their own person. And when there were hearings on this, and maybe there's doctors here, but when there were hearings at the congressional level, they asked the doctors why they needed to save this procedure. And how often? And in the first day of hearings, they said that this is absolutely a necessary procedure they need to protect for the life of the mother. And he couldn't think of any time that it was totally, this was the only way they could save the life of the mother because the baby's already delivered except 2 inches of its top of its head. And the next day, the doctors came back at the congressional hearings and said, we're going to be real truthful with you. There are no reasons for this procedure to be used to save the life of the mother. This is not a life-saving procedure for the mother. We can tell you no incident when this is necessary. And frankly, Roe v. Wade has not protected the right to abort a baby or kill a baby in the process of being born. In the birth process, Roe v. Wade does not protect that these people, the baby's lives can be taken. I think this is a heinous thing to do. I think the worst thing it is on our society. You saw what happened the other day in Colorado. And this death, it's bad enough on video games, but this whole accepting death and doctors destroying these babies is having an effect on our society. And I just wanted to come and testify in favor of this bill. And you know Congress has passed it twice, but this president has vetoed it. And they've overridden it in the House, but the Senate was a couple votes short. So I know more experts will be here to testify, but I think on behalf of these children that have almost made it through birth, I'm not going to get into the heinous procedure of how they do this, but I hope other people do, although it's very ugly. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Bowman, may I have a question for you?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Senator Shannon. Mm-hmm. This whole term, infanticide, in my opinion, is used basically just to inflame the situation. Can you give me a definition of what that means?
Infanticide is to allow a newborn baby to die or to kill it. And this baby, if the legs are moving, the arms are the hands are wiggling, the baby is totally alive in the doctor's arms, and the head is out except for 2 inches. They have to keep 2 inches in the birth canal, and they stick a pair of scissors in the back of the neck and put a tube in and suck out the brains. And it's a live baby.
Senator Shannon, this procedure does not take place.
Oh, yes, it does. I wouldn't be here if it didn't.
Do you have proof that this takes place?
Absolutely.
Are you going to provide it for
the
committee?
I'm going to ask that further questions be channeled through the chair.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here if this were not an event happening. 3,000 minimum happen in the United States every year. And if you're so sure that they're not happening, let's pass the law because we're really degrading.
Right, what I want to do is I want to avoid individual debates here. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, what I'd like to do is see us talk about this issue in a very rational manner. And what I'd like to see is proof that a procedure of a newborn baby being killed by a doctor is taking place. When people come in and use inflammatory language, that the purpose is to inflame the situation, we cannot have the rational debate that needs to take place. So I will look forward to getting information from people who will be here.
One moment to respond.
You may respond to the chair.
Okay. Representative Brown used this term, a newborn baby being killed by a doctor. That's exactly what will be described today, and evidence of that happening. Those were her words. I call it destroying, but they definitely are taking the life of the newborn baby.
Thank you, Senator Shannon. We appreciate you coming this morning. Representative Kitty Percy, good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kitty Percy. I'm a representative from House District 39. I thought a lot about whether I would testify at this hearing because I'm reluctant to give any credibility to this very political bill. From my perspective, this is another example of a social agenda that's afoot in a session. And instead of addressing the really significant issues of the state, here we are addressing a very controversial bill which would legislate medical care options. There's no such thing as partial birth. This is about politics, not medicine. Bans such as this discount women's health, and courts find them unconstitutional. Legislators could and should do more to prevent unintended pregnancies, such as a bill that is in this body to ensure contraceptive coverage for women. And that bill is not getting a hearing. This bill would undermine a physician's ability to determine the best choice of treatment for a patient. Good medicine, good medical judgment, not politics, should dictate which medical procedures are safest and most appropriate for patients. And for that reason, I'm here this morning to speak on behalf of myself and for many, many women across this country who want this to be a personal medical decision and not a part of the politics of this building and not medical procedure legislated from this body. Thank you for letting me come and express my opinion.
Thank you, Representative. Mm-hmm. Apparently there are no questions. Now, separate topic, Representative, are you interested in testifying on House Bill 3343, which is your bill? It's third up this morning.
My bill?
I think it is.
The Bork bill? Is that up this morning?
It's the task force.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait a minute. That's Representative Gianella's.
Okay. No? I don't think mine's up this
morning. Yours is up tomorrow, then. You had a bill of...
that you had indicated you would let me...
I'm sorry. I had the wrong one here.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Dr. Richard Thorne? Good morning and welcome to the committee. And Emily Wood, the temporary assistant to Patsy Wood, will take your written testimony and distribute it. Emily Wood is here on Take Your Daughter to Work Day, and she is the daughter of Patsy Wood, our able committee assistant. Thank you. And I have been receiving notes from legislators about the other committees where they've been testifying. This is a heavy hearings day to explain that to all of our witnesses. Doctor, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Richard M. Thorne. I'm a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist who now specializes in the area of fertility. Having trained in the largest active hospital in the United States, USC LA County Medical Center, for 5 years, I had contact with a large number of high-risk pregnancies on a continuing basis. This also included management of every complication known for criminal abortion, since abortion was illegal at that time. My training served me well as chief of OBGYN at Irwin Army Hospital in Kansas, and the need continued for high-risk obstetrical care during my first 15 years of practice. Before I reached my fourth decade of life, I had either personally delivered or supervised approximately 10,000 deliveries. I'm a fellow of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I'm a member of the American Medical Association, American Reproductive Society, a member of the Society of Reproductive Surgeons, and a member of FACT, which stands for Physicians Ad Hoc Coalition for Truth About Partial Birth Abortion. This organization was developed after the appalling medical misinformation circulated in all forms of media regarding the procedure of partial birth abortion. FACT includes in its membership over 600 physicians from obstetrics, maternal and fetal medicine, and pediatrics. Many of those are physicians, are educators, or heads of departments, and also include the former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop. All that is required of a physician for membership is an interest in maternal and child health and a desire to educate the population at large on this single issue. I begin my testimony by defining what partial birth abortion is. It is a feet-first delivery of a living infant up to the level of its after-coming head before puncturing the base of its skull with a sharp instrument and sucking out the brain contents, therefore killing it, allowing the collapse of its skull and subsequent delivery. Even those exact words of partial birth abortion have not been used and seen in medical dictionaries up to 1995, I believe it justly and succinctly describes the procedure in an honest fashion. This description is based upon a technique of Dr. Haskell in Ohio, who had subsequently identified it as accurate. He has referred to his technique as DNX, standing for dilatation and extraction. Dr. McMahon of California referred to it as an intact D&E. The American College of OBGYN Ad Hoc Committee came up with a hybrid term of an intact D&X, a combination of the first two. As you can see, many terms are used and are not clear in their description other than what has been described by the definition I defined initially. Why are they done and how often? Partial birth abortion is most commonly performed in the fifth and sixth months of pregnancy. However, these procedures have been performed up to the ninth month of pregnancy. The majority of patients undergoing these procedures do not have any significant medical problems. In Dr. McMahon's series, less than 10% were performed for maternal reasons, and those included some ill-defined reasons such as depression, hyperemesis, which is nausea and vomiting of pregnancy, or drug-exposed spouse or youth. Many of the patients undergoing partial birth abortion are not even carrying babies with abnormalities. Again, in Dr. McMahon's series, only half the babies were considered flawed, and these included some easily correctable conditions such as cleft palate or ventricular septal defect, a small hole in the wall of the heart. Dr. Haskell's series claimed that 80% of his procedures were purely elective. A group of New Jersey physicians claimed that only a small amount of their procedures were done for genetic abnormalities or other defects. The most common reason were women of lower age, education, or social economic status who for various reasons delayed or discovered late that they were pregnant and that the pregnancy was simply unwanted. It is also clear that this procedure occurs not rarely as stated by President Clinton, but thousands of times a year. Ronald Fitzsimmons, chairman of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, admitted that he had lied on Nightline when he originally said that this was, quotes, a rare and unusual procedure, end of quotes, and that he later admitted 3,000 to 5,000 of these procedures are done annually. This has been independently confirmed and collaborated by the investigated work of the Washington Post, the New Jersey Record, and the American Medical Association News.
Dr. Thorne, I'm going to mention to you that we do have your written testimony, which we're including in the record. What I would ask you to do at this point is to summarize the rest of the points that you would like to highlight from that testimony. That's our usual practice in this committee.
Correct.
No problem. I didn't mention that before. But I appreciate your having provided this helpful information, particularly since it's in written form and we can track that.
I would like to then skip down to primarily the myths, if I can. It's about 2 pages. Okay. I would like to spend the remaining moments talking about the disinformation of the major media on this subject. Myth number one is partial birth abortion, only done in extreme cases for severe fetal abnormalities or for severe threats to maternal well-being. Despite the rhetoric of rare, extreme, and threatening, the overwhelming number of partial birth abortions were done for elective reasons and for pediatric reasons, which Dr. McMahon described as teenagers, a pregnancy occurring in teenagers. Myth number two, the ban would jeopardize maternal health. As mentioned by the American Medical Association, they stated that this procedure is not ever medically indicated for any obstetrical reason and is not good medicine. Its primary use is one of cost effectiveness, where more procedures can be done in a hurry as opposed to saving the life of the baby or mother. Myth number three, and this I'd like to concentrate on. It's been stated by Ellen Goodman and by Kate Michelson, president of NALRA, that this procedure, when it is started, that does not hurt the baby is already dead from the anesthetic, and that the baby can feel no pain. Dr. Robert White, a neurosurgeon, stated by the 20th week, the fetus has neurocirculatory systems to perceive pain that are probably greater than the adult. He states, quote, without question, all of this is a dreadful, painful experience for the infant subjected to such a surgical procedure. The procedure, if done on an animal in my institution, would not make it through the institutional review process. The animal would be more protected than the child would have to go through this procedure. Further on, it's been shown that the preborn infant is more sensitive to pain than the adult, primarily because it's a shorter distance to travel from brain to the skin. Number two, in-house opiates, our own natural morphine that suppress pain, are not really established until the infant is term. Number three, a cutaneous flexor reflex in the preterm has a lower threshold. In layman's terms, meaning that it takes less stimulation to cause that pain, which starts around the mouth of the infant at the 7th week, and by the 20th week, all these cutaneous receptors of pain response are there by the 20th week. That the neurotransmitters, or chemicals which transmit pain from synapses of one nerve cell to another, are definitely present, and the ones that enhance pain are present in the preterm infant as opposed to those that modulate or downregulate. In summary, as an obstetrician and a gynecologist, I find, even to debate about this procedure, the misinformation by the media, the perpetual deceit by the President of the United States, to be foundless. In the past year alone in Oregon, we have had 10 infants murdered by their parents or mother for various social reasons. The yuppie couple Amy Grossberg and Brian Peterson, along with prom queen Melissa Drechler, who literally trashed their infants, were given token sentences of 20 to 30 months. The basic legal precept is that there's no intrinsic value to human life unless wanted by the mother. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin, a 37-year-old man was sentenced to 12 years in prison for killing cats. A father who did not want to pay child support to his son in California injects his 11-month-old son with HIV virus. And recently in the state of Washington, a mother left her child under the care of her boyfriend, who alleged the child drowned in a bathtub while he was at a pub drinking beer. When discovered, they also put their child in a trash can and burned it in the park. The district attorney is having a hard time trying to find out what law was broken, since there's no remains to refute what is the truth and what is not. An international bioethicist, Peter Singer, who favors infanticide and has written that an animal has more rights than a disabled child, has been given the prestigious chair of bioethics at Princeton University. 28 states have passed a ban on partial birth abortion, yet 17 have been enjoined by a temporary or permanent ban. The judiciary judges stating the ban is vague, since one cannot determine, and this is the important point, when abortion ends and infanticide begins. It is time to put a stop to the blurring lines of potential infanticide. We need your help to support a partial birth abortion ban, which would, in its essence, awaken society from its trip towards the inevitable infanticide belief. Thank you for your patience and attention.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Bowman has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dr. Thorne. Dr. Thorne, it's clear that you are a pro-life proponent, and that's okay. And I am pro-choice, and so we're not going to agree on some real basic issues. My question to you, however, is this in fact a move to do away with legal abortions, period?
Not at all.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair. The cases that you talked about, the horrendous activities that some parents do to their children, is an issue that we struggle with in this body almost every day, especially this particular committee here. However, those children have absolutely nothing to do with the conversation that we're having today, which is about a legal procedure that people, that women have the option to use because women have choice. No matter how horrendously horrific you try to make it sound, what you're trying to say is that you don't want people to have that choice.
I would say that this has nothing to do with impairing Roe versus Wade. There is a small Texas statute that is not persuaded by the Roe-Wade argument at all, which states that a baby in parturition, in the process of birth, that word means the birth process, is considered a homicide. And that has been upheld by the Supreme Court. In no way does this procedure impinge on anybody's choice about abortion. We are talking about the difference of this procedure versus all the other horrendous ways to kill, piecemeal, pulling it out, sucking it out, injecting it. This is in the process of the birth, and this is what sets it aside from all other. It does not in any way infringe on anybody's right because of that, because the child is in the process of birth.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up. Dr. Thorne, at 5 months pregnancy, someone is not in the process of giving birth.
That's a good question. A lot of confusion is the difference between live birth and term. Live birth is defined as any infant, listen now please, any infant after 20 weeks who even comes out with one gasp of breath is considered by legal and medical terms to be a live birth. The confusion, and this is why we have the FACT Coalition, is to try to educate people that there are differences of words. Full term means anything over 37 weeks. Live birth is anything over 20 weeks who comes out may gasp once. That is considered legally a live birth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Hansen.
Yes, Doctor. Obviously, we haven't had time to go through all of your testimony, and we won't be able to do that today. But what would be very helpful to me in trying to understand all of this testimony is if you could provide us your documentation for the facts that are in here.
There's a bibliography in the back.
Well, there's bibliography, but it's... It's relatively, for example, in the why, in the second page, why they are done and how often. You have made some pretty basic statements in terms of numbers. Could I have the documentation on that?
Right, that's all from the Senate hearings in front of the U.S. Senate. This was Dr. Haskell's testimony. It's listed in the bibliography, the days that he testified in front of the U.S. Senate.
Okay. Is his documentation available somewhere?
It is.
Or are
you
just accepting his opinion of the numbers and percentages?
This is the quote from that is from the American Medical News. Then he had a personal interview, and that has been actually gotten from the American Medical Association. The date, I believe, was May 17th, 1995. And that is his testimony given by the reporter to the American Medical Association News.
But it's his testimony and not the documentary basis for his testimony.
He said basically, for example, that 80% of his procedures were elective. He has said that in quote, both in front of the U.S. Senate and also in an interview with the American Medical Association News.
Thank you.
Dr. McMahon is deceased, died of lung cancer 2 years ago.
Thank you very much, Doctor. There appear to be no further questions. We appreciate your coming this morning.
Thank you.
We're going to temporarily recess the public hearing on House Bill 3583. I'm going to try to run through a few other quick procedural items. I know Representative Close is here, and I will be calling you up shortly. I understand we have one witness here on 2744.
She's going to leave.
Well, she'll be back. Excuse me, I have two witnesses here on 2744. I meant 2434. Kathy Osborne. She's still here. Well, when she comes back, somebody might mention to her that we're not working that bill today. And I didn't know if she wanted to make some brief comments, but that was a tap in, tap out. Mr. Rice, I'll wait for a moment to see if she could come back in. On House Bill 3086, how many folks do we have here today on House Bill 3086? All right. Patsy, we're going to go into public hearing on House Bill 3086. Public hearing is convened. Seeing that there are no witnesses, House Bill 3086, public hearing is adjourned. On 3084, we had one person here, and obviously what I'm trying to do is to help some folks out who may not be here for this more lengthy testimony to let them get on with some other business. Is there somebody here? There was a hand before on 3084. Sort of like going once, going twice, going three times. And I'll explain to the members of the public who aren't used to this process that we have a deadline for posting a hearing. We can later have work sessions on these bills. But a lot of these were set because they have relating clauses that are very convenient. So I'm not too worried about folks being left out. They can always come in later to talk to us. I'm going to take us into public hearing on House Bill 3084. The public hearing is convened. Are there any witnesses? Seeing no witnesses, the public hearing on House Bill 3084 is adjourned. And did you find Kathy Osborne?
I didn't hear her, man. So I looked in the hallway.
Well, you might let her know, Mr. Rice, that we're not intending to proceed with that bill. It has a handy relating clause. I assume that she was concerned about the bill and intended to testify against.
I don't know what she was going to do, but I'll be happy to relay that message.
And if it turns out that she wanted to submit some testimony, I'd be happy to arrange for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will convene the public hearing on House Bill 2434. The hearing is convened. Are there any witnesses present? I will note for the record that Kathy Osborne had signed the witness sheet, and we will accept any written comments from her should she wish to submit them, and we will certainly offer her an opportunity to present any concerns should we hold a work session on that bill. Since no one is present at this time, however, we will take no testimony, and this concludes the public hearing on House Bill 2434. I have two people here on House Bill 2744, and I am going to convene the public hearing on House Bill 2744. I'm going to ask counsel to briefly summarize the measure.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2744 requires the county juvenile departments enter some specified information about youths, specifically youths who may violate the law, into juvenile justice information systems utilized by counties and state. That includes, but is not limited to, the name, date of birth, and their gender, race, or ethnicity, social security number, and the list does go on.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Karen Bazeau, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Youth Authority, and with me is Joanne Fuller, who's the Deputy Director for the Multnomah Community Justice Department. And both of us have written testimony. The Youth Authority is asking for amendments that would eliminate everything on the bill that's printed and substitute it for with concepts that you see written on page 2 of my written testimony.
How quickly do you think you can get those amendments prepared? Next week, perhaps?
I'd love to.
Both of you like the concept, but you want it cleaned up considerably, right?
Yes.
Is there anybody in this room who's opposed to this bill? Seeing none. What I'd like to suggest, respectfully, is that if you can get those amendments crafted, we will hold a work session next Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, depending, probably Wednesday, to give you some time to get them. And absent any, and I'd ask you also to provide them to the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, any other concerned parties, and we will certainly invite anyone to testify at the work session if there's any concern. We'd be happy to accommodate you, and I welcome any additional remarks you'd like to make this morning.
That's fine with me. Do I need to work with Mr. Horton on getting...
Yes. Mr. Horton?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask, do you need a note from me down to legislation? Okay, I'll get that to you today.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, you've come down from Multnomah County. I do have your written testimony, but if you'd like to make some remarks, we'd welcome that.
I don't think so, other than that Multnomah County would support this bill with the OIA's proposed amendments.
Very good. And I suppose the key is to get the results, and that's what we'll work for here. Thank you for coming.
Thanks.
Seeing no other witnesses, the public hearing on House Bill 2744 is adjourned. We'll plan on a work session on that bill next week. We will now turn back to page 1. I'm going to ask how many people are here on House Bill 3343. Kathy Osborne, since I didn't have you in on the other one, come on up. And again, folks, this will just take a couple more minutes, but I am trying to give folks a chance to get to some other hearing rooms. We will convene the public hearing on House Bill 3343. Counsel, would you summarize the measure?
Mr. Chairman, this bill is relating to juveniles, and what it does is it creates a joint legislative task force on juvenile violence, and it consists of 5 Oregon senators and 6 members of the House of Representatives. Both of those are, of course, at the state level, not the national level. And the task force is directed to review the laws of Oregon relating to juvenile delinquency and firearm possession by juveniles, and then to submit a report on those topics to the next legislative assembly.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Mannix, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. I checked the against box, but it's probably not really true. We're probably neutral on this, unlike Mr. Rice's neutrality. We actually think this is a very, very good idea, and it's something that needs to happen. What we would like to see, though, is have this expanded to encompass the other people in Oregon who are actually working on the issue of juvenile violence. Juvenile violence, the serious juvenile offenders are the group of individuals that I personally have been working with and been concerned about for the past 9 years of my professional life. And I know in Oregon that there are a large number of individuals on both sides of this very interesting topic that have some very innovative and very good ideas about what Oregon can do to help stop the tide of juvenile violence and especially the use of guns by juveniles. And I would just encourage that this body consider expanding this past just a joint legislative task force and make this into something which can come into the next legislative session with some very, very good ideas. And I think during the interim, this is an issue that we could probably reach a lot of consensus on if we all get together and are able to spend a lot of time talking about it and working on the various issues.
Thank you. And we'd welcome your suggestions for amendments as to how this ought to be set up.
I'll certainly work with Representative Gianella and Council for how this possibly could be amended to make it into something that I think that would be really worthwhile for the state of Oregon and could be a model for the rest of the country.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House Bill 3343? Seeing no further testimony, the hearing is adjourned. And I will bring up one more and get us back to our original agenda, the partial birth infanticide bill. On House Bill 2454.
We have successive amendments that I think you did want to work on those. So.
Please come forward, Mr. Taylor. I'll go ahead and call us into public hearing on House Bill 2454. You're neutral, according to the sheet. Would you like to comment on this bill?
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Scott Taylor, Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. When we saw the bill, we were just interested. We discussed its impact on the department. We wanted to make sure that in the record there were a few issues that might be discussed. One of our concerns is to ensure that as this is worked on and the guidelines reviewed, that things such as post-prison supervision that currently have very clear links of time and management are restated so that we know for sure how long we would have somebody. We also are concerned with our ability, I'm sure the study will review the ability to project or forecast populations if we don't have if we have that kind of possible fluctuation in sentences. And third, we would just like to encourage, given the number of bills that have been passed and laws passed since 1989, I'm sure that part of the work of this group would also be a broader look at the number of sentences and the kind of overlay we have, and anything we could do to standardize or simplify those relationships, we would like to see done.
Mr. Taylor, have you seen the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments that we drafted as to this bill?
No, sir, I have not.
They're both getting stuff amendments.
Okay.
So what I'd invite you to do is take a look at those also. And I see James Rice and Steve Dingle signed up on this bill. The original intent of the bill is still something we can consider going forward with. And you might let us know how important you think that might be as opposed to these amendments.
Okay.
I certainly don't want to surprise the world, so I'm letting the world know there are Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to this bill. And should we hold a work session, folks who want to come in and be heard, although technically it'll be a work session, I'll certainly invite them up. So please take a look at those. And I don't see Mr. Dingle in the room. Mr. Rice is here. I'll ask both of you to confer with counsel to see whether or not you want to testify in this bill or would like to be invited to come in when we have a work session. You too, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. And I could take 5 minutes to explain to everybody what we're doing, but it's all part of the arcane legislative procedures that we use to expedite matters. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify in House Bill 2454? Seeing there's no one else, we adjourn the hearing on House Bill 2454. And we return and reconvene to the hearing on House Bill 3583. Thank you for your patience. Gail Atterbury, please come forward. Did you want someone up with you, Ms. Atterbury? Did you want someone up with you, or are you on your own? No, that's fine. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Gail Atterbury. I'm the executive director and lobbyist for Oregon Right to Life, and I'm pleased to be here. I will skip some of my testimony for shortness of time. I brought two models to just explain to you a little more and further about partial birth abortion. Partial birth abortion method is done on infants in the womb from 20 weeks. This is an anatomically correct size of a 20-week
abortion. I will mention for the record that Gail Atterbury requested my permission to use display objects, and I granted her permission. So please go ahead.
Thank you. An anatomically correct unborn child at 20 weeks. They're most commonly done from 20 weeks to 30 weeks. This is a 30-week unborn child at this anatomically correct size. They can be, it is legal to go up to 40 weeks also. Partial birth abortion has been debated extensively in Congress with both houses. Oh, I'm sorry. Should I
Emily Wood, our volunteer committee assistant.
Thank you. I always forget to do that. Partial birth abortion has been debated extensively in Congress in both houses, with both houses declaring this procedure to be inhumane and inconsistent with our compassionate society. Two times, both houses of Congress passed a ban on the partial birth abortion procedure. Two times, President Clinton vetoed the ban. The House was successful in overriding his veto both times, but the Senate fell short of the two-thirds vote needed both times. A vast amount of testimony submitted to Congress included.
And I'll mention to you, too, Ms. Atterbury, we do have your written testimony.
Yes.
And let's conclude that in the record. I certainly welcome your paraphrasing or summarizing.
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Mannix. There is just a couple points that I would like to make, and I am certainly condensing it. Thank you.
Speed up things a little bit.
Thank you. I would like to make a couple quotes that have been very significant in the congressional testimony. One was an eyewitness report of a partial birth abortion by Brenda Pratt Schaefer, a registered nurse with 13 years of experience, who was assigned by her nursing agency to an abortion clinic. Since she considered herself very pro-choice, she didn't think this assignment would be a problem. Since she was wrong, and she appeared before Congress to testify to what she had seen. I stood at the doctor's side and watched him perform a partial birth abortion on a woman who was 6 months pregnant. The baby's heartbeat was clearly visible on the ultrasound screen. The doctor delivered the baby's body and arms, everything but his little head. The baby's body was moving. His little fingers were clasping together. He was kicking his feet. The doctor took a pair of scissors and inserted them into the back of the baby's head, and the baby's arm jerked out in a flinch, a startle reaction, like a baby does when he thinks he might fall. Then the doctor opened the scissors up. Then he stuck the high-powered suction tube into the hole and sucked the baby's brains out. Now the baby was completely limp. The American Medical Association endorsed the federal partial birth abortion ban. In a letter addressed to Senator Senatorium, the association said, "Thank you for the opportunity to work with you towards restricting a procedure we all agree is not good medicine." Ron Fitzsimmons, executive director of the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, admitted in March 1977 article published in the American Medical News that he lied through his teeth when he said the procedure was used rarely and only on women whose lives were in danger, whose fetuses were damaged. He said the procedure is performed far more often than his colleagues have acknowledged in unhealthy women bearing healthy fetuses. An investigative reporter for the Record of Bergen, which is a daily newspaper of Bergen County, New Jersey, reported doctors in a local clinic admitting that the clinic performed at least 1,500 partial birth abortions a year, most all for elective reasons, people who didn't realize or didn't care or for how far along they were. Dr. Thorne has succinctly summarized that this partial birth abortion procedure is never medically necessary, and I do have statements in my testimony about that, and you can read those and read the people that are endorsing that. Currently, approximately 33 states have passed bans on partial birth abortion. There's some more recently in this last legislative session that have passed some. The majority of these bans are being held up in court. Some have been declared unconstitutional, and 7 are currently in effect. The U.S. Supreme Court has not yet heard a partial birth abortion ban case. And that's in the testimony that I've given you. The very last page is the Oregon Vital Stats. It is not known whether partial birth abortions are being performed in Oregon. According to 1997 Oregon Vital Stats, which you have, there were 252 abortions performed at or after 21 weeks, the time during which partial birth abortions are done. Under the Vital Stats report, which details methods, there is no category listed as partial birth abortion. However, there are two abortions listed under other. If partial birth abortions are not being done in Oregon, we can all be very, very glad. As we can plainly hear from the experts, partial birth abortions are absolutely unnecessary. Our own senses tell us that the procedure is cruel and inhumane. We can take this opportunity, which HB 3583 offers us, to ensure that this barbaric procedure does not happen in Oregon. I urge your support of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Atterbury. I don't see any questions, so you may step down. We appreciate your coming this morning.
Thank you.
Mike Howden. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mike Howden. I'm come to you this morning on behalf of the Oregon Physicians Resource Council. I'm not a physician myself, but I'm coming as a representative for that group of people. I'm not going into every detail of the front two pages of my testimony there. The procedure's been outlined already and explained in quite a bit of detail. The Physicians Resource Council here in Oregon has three primary concerns, and let me speak to those quickly. First, the procedure itself defies the ethical treatment of a child. When you consider the procedures, how it's conducted, the physical presence of the child's body in the physician's hand during the final fatal part of the procedure illuminates that we have more than just a simple mass of tissue. Except for the skull, every element and part is visible to document that, in fact, there exists a living human being in the room at that time. We can see their limbs, their movement, and also whether they're a boy or a girl. In fact, every physiological fact at that point says that the head of the child certainly does exist with all the newborn characteristics associated with it. A profound question for many physicians, including the physicians that I represent here this morning, is how can all the biological and medical evidence be ignored concerning the viability of that infant? Interestingly enough, even this morning in South Salem, I have a 14-year-old nephew who plays basketball, runs, and from time to time gives his teachers a difficult time. He was born prematurely, just before the six-month period. And for the sake of his lungs being advanced at that point, Ben was in for literally the fight of his life, but survived. Second, while protecting the life or health of the mother is claimed as the chief goal for performing the procedure, the facts betray this reason. Mothers sincerely believe this to be true while not knowing of all the medical consensus that exists on this question. In fact, AMA President Daniel Johnson, Jr., MD, said in a New York Times article in 1997, "The partial delivery of a living fetus for the purpose of killing it outside the womb is ethically offensive to most Americans and physicians. Our panel could not find any identified circumstances in which the procedure was the only safe and effective abortion method." And Dr. Martin Haskell, a name that was in question a few minutes ago, an abortionist who has performed more than 1,000 partial birth abortions, said about 80% are done for purely elective reasons. The other 20% are done for genetic reasons, which include such non-life-threatening conditions as having a cleft palate or Down syndrome. Those were his comments recorded in the American Medical News 1993. I've included for the committee also a document you'll see attached, and on it, in that, is a paper by Dr. Martin Haskell. It was submitted to the National Abortion Federation, and it was given at a seminar in which he describes in great detail this procedure, how he had used it, and what were the percentages of times in which it occurred. According to Pamela Smith, the Director of Medical Education in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, there are absolutely no obstetrical situations encountered in this country which require a partially delivered human fetus to be destroyed to preserve the health of the mother. Then third, the claims that anesthesia received by the mother for pain kills the baby is false. During testimony before the House Judiciary Committee in November 1995, Dr. David Birnbach, Director of Obstetric Anesthesiology at St. Luke's Hospital in New York, said, "Every day we have pregnant patients who get anesthesia, women who break their ankles, need knee surgery, have appendectomies, gallbladder removals, breast biopsies, and so on. Anesthetics done safely by an anesthesiologist do no harm to either the mother or the baby." Concerning the question of whether or not the underdeveloped fetus feels pain, Professor Robert White, Director of the Division of Neurosurgery and Brain Research Laboratory at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine in Cleveland, told the same subcommittee this: "The fetus within this time frame of gestation, 20 weeks and beyond, is fully capable of experiencing pain. Without a doubt, This is a dreadfully painful experience for any such infant subjected to such a surgical procedure. And for the committee, I've also added some other documents, and you'll see the front of those documents that include a paper, a statement by Dr. Jean A. Wright, who is a specialist in this area of anesthesiology, in which she documents the very statements just made. And there is other additional copies of testimony given to Congress by experts on the same question. As to whether or not this is a concern for Oregon, we can only refer to the fact that we are completely dependent on the physician's willingness to report such a procedure. Other facts have already been discussed regarding the situation with Ron Fitzsimmons and the National Coalition of Abortion Providers. We urge this committee to vote in favor of this bill, even for those, and we urge that in lieu of all women, even for those whose life hangs in the very palm of a physician's hand at the critical moments of birth. Thank you for your time and appreciate your work on this bill.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming. It appears that we do not have any questions for you. Sandy Hansen? Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sandy Hansen. I'm the executive director of Oregon NARAL, the Oregon affiliate of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. I have a very short statement. We urge you to leave this decision to doctors. The American Medical Association has gone on record stating that medical decisions about late-term abortions should be handled by doctors. The AMA recognizes that there are sometimes extraordinary circumstances around third trimester abortions. It does refuse to support legislation that attempts to ban late-term abortion, and it rejects the use of the term partial birth abortion because it is not a medical term. If there are medical questions about procedures that are safe for women who face medical emergencies late in pregnancy, the debate should be among medical professionals and not government officials. Oregon NARAL agrees with the AMA. Government leaders are not elected to practice medicine. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have a question for you.
Yes.
Where would you start the line of governmental protection? That is, where would you say that intervention is appropriate?
For
an infant. Or, we'll say, late-term fetus. Separate protection as opposed to protection.
Again, I think the discussion needs to start with medical professionals who know much more about that than I.
Well, let me work backwards then. I assume that a one-year-old should be legally protected as a separate human being. That's pretty obvious, right?
Mr. Chair, we do have laws about viability issues. We do have certain, again, medical procedure for you and I to discuss.
Now, let's not talk about medical procedures. Let's talk about where we draw the line. You've said that medical procedures should be left to a debate between, well, a discussion between doctors and their patients.
Yes.
We have a number of bills in front of us where we have government intervention on behalf of children. Now I'm asking, let's work our way backwards and try to determine what your position is as to where the government has a legitimate opportunity to intervene. I assume we can all agree that someone who's been alive for 1 year outside the womb, government can intervene. That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes.
Let's move back to 6 months. Are you still okay on that? Government should be able to intervene?
In all cases, though, you are talking about children who have been born, who have been alive,
right,
who have been viable
okay.
for
so
several
you would agree
months.
From birth onwards, government can intervene?
We do already, don't we?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where we draw the line, and I'm working my way backwards. Your position would be during the process...
The law that we are talking about, though, the measure that is before you, I did not think was there to describe necessarily a definition of infanthood as much as proscribe a medical procedure, and that's what I am here to talk about.
Well,
I will leave you with my testimony, but I am not qualified to talk about medical procedures, medical terms, and nor am I really prepared or able to give to you a full discussion today on legal definitions.
You have read the bill.
I have not seen the latest DASH measures.
Oh, no, I mean the original bill.
Yes.
In fact, the term abortion doesn't appear in this bill, and I've heard the discussion about that. But what I'm asking is, when does infanticide begin, in your opinion?
I really have not thought through on that issue because
right.
I am not.
Okay.
That's not what I'm here for.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? We appreciate your coming this morning. Lois Backus? Patsy, we'll get your testimony. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
I'm Lois Backus. I'm the Executive Director of Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette, and I am here today representing Planned Parenthood Affiliates of Oregon, which is a coalition of the Planned Parenthood Affiliates in Oregon, which serves 30,000 women in Oregon every year with family planning, counseling, and education services. And we also have 10 clinics throughout the state, from Bend to Grants Pass and in the Portland area as well. Planned Parenthood opposes House Bill 3583. I am not here today to address the merit or lack of merit of any medical procedure. We believe that those discussions need to be conducted by licensed medical providers. Legislators cannot and should not be governing medical judgment. It's bad law and it's bad public policy. Planned Parenthood has worked long and hard in this state and across the world to make birth control services and pregnancy prevention services truly accessible to all women. We have worked very hard here in Oregon, as I'm sure many of you are aware, to help with public policy that would make unintended pregnancy very, very rare. If we can defeat unintended pregnancy, then we can eliminate the need for abortion in this state. And I think we can all agree that that is a common goal. I would also like to say that ultimately what we want to see is for every child to be planned, wanted, loved, and well cared for. If we together can achieve that, then we will not have any need for bills such as House Bill 3583. And again, I would like to ask for your support in those efforts and plead with you to understand that House Bill 3583 is bad law and bad public policy, and this is not a direction in which we want to go. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. I have a question for you. You probably heard me ask Sandy Hansen's question. At what point would you support government intervention to protect, I'll say, a newborn, an infant, however, whatever phrase you want to use, when does government get to intervene on behalf of what we would define at some point as a new human being?
Planned Parenthood has always been fully supportive of all child protection laws following the birth of a child. That includes child endangerment laws, parental neglect laws. We are fully supportive of the state stepping in and taking action to protect all born children.
And how would you define born?
I think we're well aware. We all have a common definition of what the birth of a child entails. Again, as Sandy Hansen said, I am not a physician, but it is generally understood that a born child is one who is born by any legitimate medical procedure or in someone's home or the back of a car or wherever, and which child breathes and continues to survive on its own.
Well, obviously, I am curious about where that beginning point is. I would always welcome the submission of some medical information if you want to submit it about because that is not a facetious question, because if we're going to talk about governmental intervention, at some point you draw a line, and that's the question that I'm raising.
With all due respect to Representative Mannix, the line has been drawn. Roe versus Wade draws a very clear line, allowing any state legislature to make bills that would prescribe pregnancy termination in the third trimester. It is very clearly done. Planned Parenthood supports Roe versus Wade and has always done so. And that is not what we are here today to discuss. House Bill 3583 does not do what Roe versus Wade does in the way of providing guidance and prescription around the protection.
Would you agree that Mr. Justice Stewart was one of the primary participants in the affirmative decision in Roe versus Wade?
No, I am not that familiar with each of the justices and where they stood on Justice Blackmun's decision.
All right, I would direct your attention to the transcript of the second round of oral argument in Roe versus Wade, where the oral argument debate went on, and Mr. Justice Stewart and one of the lawyers went out of their way to say that they were not dealing with the process of killing a child in the process of childbirth, that abortion was separate from that. And that's why I'm trying to define where the lines are drawn, because there was a Texas statute that was mentioned a little earlier in testimony, and it has to do with the process of killing a child during, or the act of killing a child during the process of childbirth. And we've heard a little bit about the Texas statute, but in that very, very case, and I'll just quote one short part, Mr. Justice Stewart says that it is an offense to kill a child in the process of childbirth. Mr. Flowers responds, yes, sir, it would be immediately before childbirth or right in the proximity of the child being born. Mr. Justice Marshall, which is not an abortion. Mr. Flowers, which is not, would not be an abortion. Yes, sir, you're correct, sir, it would be homicide. So, unquote. And I realize that this is something new for you, but I'm just welcoming some testimony or submissions as to where we would draw the line then as to the birthing process. I understand apparently that everyone agrees once a child has been delivered outside the mother, the birthing process is over, but there is still some debate about where that line is drawn, and I'm trying to clarify it.
Well, and I would also repeat that I do not believe that any of us at this table are the ones who should be drawing that line. That line belongs in the judgment of trained and licensed medical providers only.
Mr. Chair.
I would just submit, observing this witness and the last witness, that these two witnesses seem to be hiding behind...
Mr. Representative Simmons, please do not characterize the testimony.
Okay, well, I'll just offer that the process cannot be justified, and so we dodge the issue. So.
That sounds like more of a comment than a question. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to know if there is a ORS definition of infanticide. Is there ORS definition?
Are you asking this witness or
no, Mr. Chair, I'm asking you.
I'll be glad to take a look. Do you have any questions for this witness?
Oh, I do not. I appreciate you being
Thank
here today.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
We'll pause for a moment and I'll check out the words
Thank
and
you.
Phrases.
Yes, then let's not go there.
No, I'm not going to have our representatives. It's okay to ask questions, even leading questions, but I'd like to draw the line at leading questions.
We all have been.
Mm-hmm.